I'm so happy to see you all. It's the first time I've been able to see more than about two of you in all these times. There's something about that place, maybe because of the kinds of movies that were shown there, I don't know. But I must say it's a great relief to be here. The subject, have you seen the billboards? They're quite something. I have six billboards in the city with my picture and Master's picture, and they say the goal of life is bliss. And so what other subject can I possibly talk about except bliss? I would like to begin by reading from Conversations with Yogananda this subject, which is of all things the most important. I'm going to read you two sayings. The Master used to tell us, if you practice even a hundredth part of what I teach you, you will find God. It must be the right hundredth part, of course, but apart from that. Saying number 10 in this book. Toward the end of the Master's life, he experienced a prolonged illness. One afternoon, when he had begun to come out of his quarters again, he was getting into his car. I and another monk were helping him. "You are getting better, sir," I exclaimed gratefully. "Who is getting better?" The Master's tone was impersonal. "I meant your body, sir," I replied. I knew, of course, that he had no attachment to it. To him, however, the very distinction was superficial. "What's the difference?" he asked. "The wave belongs entirely to the ocean from which it protrudes. This is God's body. If he wants to make it well, all right. If he wants to keep it unwell, all right. It is wisest to be impartial. If you have health, but are attached to it, you will always be afraid of losing it. And if you fear that loss but become ill, you will suffer. Why not remain forever joyful in the self? Man's greatest problem is his ego, his consciousness of individuality. Whatever happens to him, he thinks it affects him personally. Why be affected? You are not this body. You are he. Everything is he. All is spirit. Unfortunately, mankind sees everything as separate and individual. The Lord had to create that appearance. Ask yourself, however, why? Why is this a tree and you a human being? The answer is simple. Without that variety, there would be no play. It wouldn't interest you. If people saw that there was only one essence in everything, painting all the scenes, directing all the action, and acting all the parts, they would quickly tire of it. For the show to go on, there has to be activity, interest. It all has to seem real. Hence this appearance of individuality. As long as man enjoys the play for its own sake, he will go on, birth after birth, experiencing life's pleasures and pains. The Bhagavad Gita describes it as a wheel, constantly turning. To get off the wheel, you have to desire freedom very intensely. Then only will God release you. Your longing has to be fervent. If it is, and if you are determined no more to want to play, the Lord has to release you. He tries to keep you here with tests, but in his higher aspect, as the cosmic lover, he hates this show and wants you out of it. Why shouldn't he release you once he sees that you really want him alone and not his show, that you want only freedom in him, the same essence, conscious life, is in you and in that tree over there. The tree, however, was put there, whereas some free will on your part made you who and what you are. Only the wise know just where predestination ends and free will begins. Meanwhile, you must keep on doing your best according to your own clearest understanding. You must long for freedom as the drowning man longs for air. Without sincere longing, you will never find God. Desire him above everything else. Desire him that you may share him with all. That is the greatest wish. And try, meanwhile, to rise above the pains of opposites, pleasure and pain, heat and cold, sickness and health. Free yourself from the consciousness of individuality, of being separate from everyone and everything else. Keep your mind fixed steadfastly on him. Remain inwardly as unaffected as the motionless spirit you want to become. He alone is what you really are. His bliss alone is your true nature. Bliss, as I say in this poster of ours, is the true goal of life. Everybody in the world wants two things, one to escape pain, and the other to find happiness. And the reason that we all want the happiness is because we all come from him. His nature is bliss. You know, there's a very interesting addition that Master made to the definition of God that was made by Swami Shankaracharya. The history of it is this, that when Buddha came, he found that India had fallen into too much rituals, and he wanted people to get away from thinking that if you can please God with a few gestures and movements and mantras and so on, that will be enough. It is not enough. He wanted people to understand that we must do the work too. And so Buddha didn't talk much about God, because he wanted to talk about you and what you need to do. And so, as always happens, people misunderstood him. Jesus Christ came and taught certain things. He was misunderstood. Buddha came and taught certain things. He was misunderstood. Yogananda came and taught certain things. He has been misunderstood. And one of my main reasons for being here in Los Angeles is to help people to understand who he really was, what a wonderful human being he was, how full of kindness and love and sweetness. I have never in my life met a more perfect human being, and yet he is being depicted by too many of his followers as a stern disciplinarian. I suppose they're doing it for egotistical reasons. See, we were able to take it. But he wasn't stern. Yes, he was firm. That's a little different. He wanted us to get out of our delusions. So he wasn't going to pat us on the head and say, that's very nice, you're being egotistical, and that's perfectly normal. So go ahead and be as egocentric as you like. No, he was quite firm about it. Firm for our sake. He wanted us to understand that our goal in life is not this little ego or these little ego satisfactions, that our goal in life is to know who we really are in him. But when Shankaracharya came, India had fallen into a kind of atheism. Buddhism is not atheistical. But Buddhists are atheistical. And the Indians were falling away from that. And so Shankaracharya came and explained, God does exist, but he's not an elephant with an elephant's trunk. He's not a woman with four arms. He's not all these different little images that people have made to help us to understand certain aspects of God. For example, Kali. Kali is an image of the Divine Mother in both terrible and beautiful aspect. The terrible aspect being that garland of skulls, which really only means not that she's cut off all these heads, but that she is present in all minds. And her firmness is based on the need to know who you really are. And the image of Kali is really a beautiful one, but too many people have misunderstood it. And for example, there she is doing the dance of the universe, because all the universe is based on vibration. It is a vibration of God's consciousness. And so she is depicted as dancing. But then when she touches the breast of her husband who's lying prostrate, her dance ceases. Now there's a deep meaning in that, that the movement of God ceases when it touches the image, touches the infinite. Shiva, her husband, lies prostrate on the ground, not because she's beaten him into the ground, but because he isn't dancing, he isn't in vibration, he's beyond vibration. And so she puts her tongue out, and people like to depict this as being bloodthirsty. No, what it simply means is that when you made a mistake in India, and even here in the West, I've seen people do it. Uh-oh, I made a mistake. So she's really saying, uh-oh, I've gone too far. I shouldn't be dancing. I can't. My dance has to stop. And so the meaning of the image of Kali, with her four arms, each one symbolizing creation, preservation, destruction, and the offer of salvation to those who want to know God. It's a very deep and beautiful image, but it's only an image, it's a symbol. And people had begun to think that that's what God really is. And so Buddha wanted to get people away from thinking that. And in talking about what your responsibility is, people naturally, because they're always getting everything wrong, you can say that the majority is always wrong. The minority has a possibility of being right, sometimes. But in this image, Shankaracharya came to explain that God does exist, but he's not all those little symbols. And he explained that God's nature is bliss, Satchidananda, ever-existing, ever-conscious, ever-new bliss. And this is the eternal image, true image of who and what God is. But Master added a beautiful phrase to that. He said, ever-existing, ever-conscious, ever-new bliss. And this is the wonderful thing. I had a dream. It was more than a dream. It was a few months ago in the city of Florence. I'd gone to talk to our distributors there, and I was staying in a hotel room, and I suddenly saw crowds of people, all different types. People who were criminal, people who were egotistical, people who were vengeful, people who were kind, people who were forgiving, people who were loving. And I saw all these different people. And I realized that the reason we have for loving everybody is that everyone on earth is seeking that same bliss. The criminal, the mafioso, may think that bliss lies in revenge, in money and power. But he makes a mistake. And in another lifetime, he'll finally realize, well, that didn't work, so let me try another one. I've often told you this story. It's such a good story, I'm going to tell it again. So close your ears if you want to. During boot camp in World War II, there was a man who was going around looking at pieces of paper, off taking them off the ground. No, this isn't it. This isn't it. This isn't it. And that's all he would say and do. And people began to think, well, this guy's crazy. So they recommended he go to a psychiatrist. And in the psychiatrist's office, all he did, instead of answering the man's questions, was pick up pieces of paper off his desk. No, this isn't it. This isn't it. Finally, what could the psychiatrist do but recommend him for a medical discharge? When he's got this discharge, he said, this is it. And he ran off gleefully. Well, we keep thinking this is going to be it. It's not it. So the mafioso thinks maybe revenge will give it to me. But there's no happiness in revenge. Maybe money will give it to me. But there's no happiness in money. Maybe having power over people and making them afraid of me will give it to me. It doesn't do it. And so he tries this, and he tries the other, and he keeps on trying. And bit by bit he discards, as they say in India, neti neti, not this, not that. And he keeps trying until finally he realizes that it's none of these things. We are all of us here to find that ever new joy. And here in this dream, there were all these people with all their different hopes and expectations. Forgive me. But in the end, they find that this one bliss is ever new. This is the incredible thing, that this bliss is the same in every human being, but everybody's approach to bliss is different. Everybody's experience of bliss is different. It's an absolutely incredible divine scheme that this bliss is in you, and it is different from the bliss in me, and yet it's all the same bliss. I was so thrilled with this dream and this vision, in a sense, you might call it, that I had, that I wanted to write it down. And I, you know, hotels always leave notepaper around. There was nothing. I looked in my bag, there was no piece of paper I could write it on. Finally, I found a little paper doily under a glass. And on that paper doily, I had to write this whole thing. I wrote in very, very small letters. But what a wonderful reason to love everybody in the world. They're all seeking the same thing. They're seeking it according to their definition. Their experience of it will be different. But that bliss is in everybody. And if you go down the street and look at the crowds of people, so few people have any idea of what it is they really want. But everybody is seeking that same bliss. Everybody is seeking his own self in God. It's a thrilling thing to realize that everybody wants just what you want. How can you not love everybody when you feel that? Sometimes I feel like weeping when I see crowds of people, and I realize this is the one thing everybody wants. You are that ever new bliss. That's why I say on that billboard, the goal of life is bliss. We're here to find it, and it may take us a few incarnations. How many? Well, I've read books in which people say you may live two or even three lifetimes on Earth. How about several days of Brahma? How about several billion years? It doesn't take a short time to find these lessons out. It can take a very long time. But in the end, that is your destiny. You are as great as Jesus Christ, as Buddha, as Yogananda, as every great master that ever lived. And you look at yourself in the mirror and sort of try to open your eyes in the morning and see if you're still there. And you think, who, me? No, not you. But then you aren't you. There's the joke of it. You aren't this little ego. You are that infinite one who temporarily thinks, oh, this is who I am. But you are really a child of God. Yogananda used to say, a saint is a sinner who never gave up. Never allow yourself to say that you are a sinner. I remember I was 21, so naturally the habit can't have been very deep at that age. Still, I used to smoke, and I didn't mind smoking. I thought it was rather a pleasant habit. I've got something there, buried in these murky depths. Excuse me. Ta-da! Here we are. And in our search for that truth, we have to go through so many mistakes. A day of Brahma lasts as long as this universe lasts, billions of years. And then there's a night of Brahma in which everything is withdrawn into a quiescent state. Not a state of liberation, but just sort of resting as you do at night. Then the day of Brahma comes out and lasts another few billion years. And how many days of Brahma have you been going along in this world? And yet you are not that. You are the infinite. You must overcome this thought. Master used to say, a saint is a sinner who never gave up. You may have made many mistakes. Never say, I am those mistakes. When I wanted to give up smoking at the age of 21, my reasoning was perhaps a little strange, but I had decided that I wanted to seek God, and I wanted to be a hermit. And I thought, who ever heard of a hermit who smokes? I'd have to go into town and buy cigarettes with what money? And so I decided I had to give it up. But it wasn't so easy because the habit was there. And although it wasn't deep, I would think at lunchtime with my coffee after lunch how good that cigarette used to taste. And so I was like Mark Twain, who said smoking's the easiest thing in the world to give up. I've done it 1,000 times. Well, that's about the way I felt. But the one thing that I must claim in my credit was that I never, never said, I have failed. I always said, I have not yet succeeded. Now remember that. If you make a mistake, if you say something insulting to somebody and feel badly about it, don't feel badly about it. Just say, haven't yet succeeded. Or maybe you'll have to say, I'm not as perfect as I thought I was, but never mind, I'll keep trying. Nonetheless, in time, you will find, you must find, that you are not a sinner, you are a child of God. Why affirm the negative? Yogananda was at a big gathering with Amy Semple McPherson, and she shouted at one point, did that really come out of me?
She said, "You're all sinners, get down on your knees." Yogananda said, "I was the only one present who was not on his knees because I would not admit that I'm a sinner." Do you think it's a sign of humility to say that you're a sinner? No. Humility means self-forgetfulness, not self-abasement. You are a child of God and therefore potentially perfect. Live in that potential. Live in the thought that I want to be perfect. I may not be that yet. I may look at myself in the mirror and not particularly like what I see in the morning. But sooner or later, I must be as great as St. Francis, as great as Buddha, as great as any master who ever lived. Because I too am God's manifestation, and there is no other reality in the universe except that one understanding that you have come from him. There's only one religion in the world. It is not named Christianity. It is not named Judaism. It is not named Islam or Hinduism or Buddhism. It is the simple religion that everything came from God and everything must go back to God. And its name in India is Sanatan Dharma, which is to say the eternal religion. This religion is the truth, that you are a part of him and you must go back to him someday. It does no good worshiping Jesus Christ if you don't try to become like him. And wouldn't the average Christian say that it's blasphemy even to aspire to become like Jesus Christ? And yet one of the greatest Christian scriptures is called the Imitation of Christ. He came on earth not to show us how great he was, but to show us how great we are in our potential. You are a child of his. He came to show you what you can be, what you are. So if I am here today, it's really only because somebody's got to do the talking, but the truth has to be something that you respond to in yourself. Otherwise, what good is it? And why did I have so much music today? For two reasons. One is that Mukti was here and plays the piano beautifully, and so I wanted to have music. But the other thing is that music really is a language. Through music, you can say things that you cannot say through words. You know, when I first decided to write music, it was a strange thing. I'd been thrown out of SRF on my ear, you might say, with kicks and insults and God knows what else. And I just didn't know what to do with my life, because I had dedicated my life to serving my guru. I had no other purpose in living. And they said to me, never to even admit that I was his disciple. We don't want people to know that he had such a despicable disciple as you. This is the way they were talking to me. It was really a very painful experience. I may not be altogether wonderful. Any glimpse in the mirror will tell me that one. But I don't think I'm that horrible. I don't hate anybody. I never get angry. I wish everybody well. I have to think those are somewhat virtuous. So I'm not utterly despicable, even though contemptible, all right. But when I was thinking of how to serve him, different ways came to me, because I didn't have anything against the people who had thrown me out. I knew it was jealousy. I knew it was I was doing things and they weren't doing anything. I knew that that was all true. But the other side of it was that they were my own sisters. And I didn't wish them anything but love. And so I was looking for ways that would serve him without in any way being a rival to whatever they were doing. And I remember I was up in Yosemite, and I used to study singing, and I was thought to be have some potential that way as a singer. The reason I never went back to my teacher when she said this, because one day she said to me, and she was an old woman, about 75, she said, "I'm living for only one thing now, and that's to see you become a great singer." And what the hell would I sing? I mean, "O cessate di piagarmi, o lasciatemi morir," which if you translate from Italian, it sounds pretty good in Italian, as long as you don't know what it's saying. What it really is saying is, "Stop bugging me and let me die." Well, I have to say, this is not the kind of message I wanted to convey. So what would be the purpose in becoming a singer, except showing everybody what a beautiful voice I had? That was not my goal in life. So I didn't go back to her. I've always felt badly for her, but I could not be a slave to her ambitions for me. And so I did have a good voice. I do have a good voice. Might as well admit it. Oh, very humbly, but still. Still, there was a couple of boys on the seated on a bridge on the railing, singing with a guitar, and singing rather out of tune. And I felt in the mood to sing. So I said, "Would you like me to sing something?" Oh, yes, they were enthusiastic because they certainly knew they weren't doing such a good job of it. So I sang, and I didn't know what to sing, so I came up with "Swing Low, Sweet Chariot." At least it's somewhat spiritual and a beautiful melody. And they were so enthusiastic, they said, "Oh, you've got to come and sing for a party we're having tonight." And so I went and sang for this party. And they too were very enthusiastic. And I thought as I was driving home the next day that singing is a way that I could share with people, but what is there to share? Drunk the night before. That wasn't quite what I wanted to convey. And so suddenly the thought came, well, maybe I could write my own songs that have their own message. And in that way I can express Master's message through music. And as soon as I thought that, just like that, a song came to my mind, fully blown. And I stopped at a Milk Creek stand and wrote it down. I knew how to write music because I studied piano for many years. And so I wrote this song down, and then I wrote one or two more songs, and somebody heard me singing and said, "Oh, would you give a concert for our church?" I had been playing the guitar for 3 weeks. That's not quite enough to claim expertise, let's say. But I thought, being somewhat dim-witted, that, well, why not? At least it'll force me to practice. And so I practiced like mad for a week. The night came, the church, it was a church, 200 people, the room was completely filled. They wanted to create atmosphere, so they turned out all the lights. The only light in the room was a candle behind me. If there was one thing I desperately needed, it was to see those strings. But I wasn't even allowed that luxury. Somebody afterwards said to me that, "Well, those are some pretty interesting chords you used there." I said, "Yeah, they certainly were. I had no idea what they were." But somehow the concert went well. I know how to tell stories, and I was able to sing a few songs, and it went well, and it sort of launched me on my musical career. And after a time, I began to realize that it isn't only the words that can convey message, but the music itself is a message. Music is a language. And so I began branching out into writing a sonata and a string quartet and different things like that. And I found that it was so easy. I didn't have to work at it. Somehow God gave me what I wanted. You know, when people talk about all the things I've done in my life, I've written 140 books, and I've written over 400 pieces of music, and I've started 8 communities, and I've done this, and I've done that. And people tell me how much I've done, and I said, well, quite honestly, the only reason I've been able to do anything is that I haven't done anything. I haven't done it, really, I haven't. I've asked God, and then suddenly I knew what to do. But He did it. And this is how I wrote music. I would say I want to write a melody that says this, 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 and this. Give me a melody. Suddenly it would be there. And I never had to work at it. So I have to say that don't blame me. If you don't like it, don't blame me. If you do like it, don't blame me. Because honestly, I haven't done it. This beautiful sonata, really, it draws tears to my eyes listening to it. One time, one of my favorite critics, somebody who never could find anything good to say about me, and I asked him how he liked the sonata. His only comment was, well, the first movement needs words. Well, I didn't feel that it did, but I listened to him. And I suddenly realized that there were some beautiful words out there waiting to be written. So that's why I had them play the first movement and then sing the first movement at the end there. But this music just has come to me. I haven't had to work at it. People think that this is the lazy man's approach to perfection. I say, no, it isn't. Because the more you let Him do what you do in your life, the more free you become inside. When you let Him act through you, it isn't as if you were just sitting back doing nothing. Davy reminded me this morning of a time in the Hollywood church when I was the minister there. And I remembered that Master had said, when you lecture, let God speak through you. So I thought, well, why don't I just shut up and let God start speaking? So I stood there. Now, mind you, in a lecture, when there are 200 people present and they're all waiting for your next words of so-called wisdom, for you suddenly to say nothing, 2 minutes is a long time. People were perspiring, thinking I'd frozen with fear. But no, I was just comfortably waiting for God to say something. And it turned out that He did not say anything. And finally I had to realize what Master had said. I will reason, I will, I will act. But guide thou my reason, will, and activity in every path. And so it is that we must do our best. But we must ask God to do it through us. And this doesn't mean that what you do will be perfect, but it will be uplifted, and therefore it will approach perfection. You will find, if even when you make mistakes, say, God, that was your mistake. Come on, let's do it better next time. Instead of thinking, oh, I'm a sinner, I'm a sinner, I'm a sinner, let Him act through you. Give Him a chance. You'll find that bit by bit, everything you do will be more and more perfect. Because you won't be doing it. He will give you the inspiration. He will give you the... many a time in a talk of mine, I've sort of stood there and thought, gee, I wish I'd thought of that. Because I hadn't thought of it. He thought of it for me. The thought was given to me. You will see that the more you live with this thought that you are an instrument for God, and you can be a bad instrument or a good instrument. But the first thing to think is, I am an instrument, and I want to become better. God is pleased if you give Him that credit for having made a mistake. Because the more you let Him act through you, the more you will begin to see that I can do it better and better. This is how St. Francis and other saints became who they are. I remember the first time I went to Assisi, I had a wonderful experience of his presence. And I was thinking, how is it possible for a human being to be so utterly sweet? It was just a very powerful experience. And then I realized, by judging no one, by seeing everybody as your brother and sister, as seeing him as the doer of everything, but above all, by judging no one, everybody has a right to find perfection at his own pace. And if it's to take him a few billion years, he still has that right. We have no right to judge anyone. We should not even judge ourselves. We should say that I want to do my best. I will keep trying to do my best. God, help me to do my best. Sooner or later, with that attitude, you will become one with him. His bliss is your own true nature. And the reason you seek happiness is because you are seeking that true nature. You are seeking to know who you really are. There is a story, which I'll tell in the conclusion, of a musk deer. And at a certain season in the year, the musk deer secretes in a pouch in its navel the fragrance of musk. And it runs around madly trying to find where that fragrance is coming from. And sometimes in desperation it will throw itself off of high crags and crash to its death below in the mountains and the Himalayas. And then the hunters come and take away that pouch and sell it for a very costly fragrance in the marketplace. And the poet writing of this example said, "Oh, musk deer, if you had only known that the source of fragrance you were seeking lay in your own self. You are the source of the happiness you want. You won't find it in money. You won't find it in things. You won't find it anywhere. But if you learn to go within, you'll gradually discover that you are that bliss, that this is your true nature. And all the mean thoughts and selfish thoughts and so on, these are not you. They're just your mistaken directions or misdirections. In the end, you will have to be like St. Francis, with that sweetness, like Jesus with his compassion, like Buddha with his compassion and wisdom, like Yogananda, whom I am in this town right now to remind people who he was. So sweet, so kind, so absolutely loving of everybody. This is who you too are." Now, I've gone beyond my proper time, but that's because I wanted to have music too. So I still would like to ask you, in the last part of our visit here together, if any of you have any questions, and I'll do my best to answer them. Or perhaps I should ask it more formally. Any questions? Jyotish will come here because I am deaf as a post. And so he will help you to hear what you're saying. Okay? Raise your hand if you want to ask a question. Yes.
Thank you, Swami. Is there any way a person can somehow know when they're allowing God to act through them, as opposed to when they're taking it on all by themselves? Or
Can you tell me?
Is there any way that a person can know when they're allowing God to act through them or when they're acting from their own ego?
I tell you, one gives you joy and the other gives you a diminution of that joy. So when you act from ego, let us say you try to get revenge on somebody and you succeed and you think, oh boy, did I put it over on him. You will notice that there's not joy. There's a certain self-justification you may feel, but there's a diminishment of joy. Whereas if you feel God working truly through you, you will feel a certain freedom. When you act in the thought of God, never think he is oppressing you. He wants your happiness. Humility does not mean telling yourself you are no good. Humility means he is that good and I want to be one with him. So whenever you, this is the beautiful thing about morality, and it has nothing to do with social conditioning. It has nothing to do with society applauding because you're behaving the right way. You yourself, in yourself, will feel happier because you've satisfied a deep need in yourself. So morality is that which takes you closer to divine joy. Immorality is that which masquerades as joy, but in the end gives dryness and disappointment. Okay? This is a very simple test, and it applies across the board. Any other questions?
Okay. I have a specific question. If I backtrack from past life to past life, what is the starting point of my desires?
If I backtrack from past life to past life, what is the starting point of my desires?
I probably guess that it would be curiosity. However, let me put it this way, that we suffer, and we need another reason for our suffering. And this is the universal truth for all human beings, that we suffer and we don't know why. The reason for suffering is that it makes us ask that question, why am I here? Have I been born only to suffer? Is this the goal of life? Suffering actually is your best teacher. But what brought me to the spiritual path was two things. One is the realization of the universality of suffering. And the second was the realization that I could be anything any human being has ever been. I could be a criminal, given the wrong circumstances. I could be a thief. I could be a murderer. I could try to hurt people. I don't want to do those things, but what makes people go through those sufferings? It really caused me, I have to say, great agony of soul to realize how widespread suffering is in this world. And secondly, to realize that I could have done the same things that brought that suffering to them. And I tried so hard to change myself. I'd never heard the word guru. I had met many so-called wise people, and they didn't impress me as having anything that I wanted. But I knew that I needed help, because every time I'd try one thing, it was like washing a dirty shirt. You push one part of the shirt underwater because it's got an air bubble there, and the bubble moves over here and it comes up here, and you push it down and comes up here. And every time I'd work on some fault of mine, I would find that in concentrating on that one fault, another one would burst up because I hadn't been thinking about that one.
This is a never-ending task. What's the matter? And I desperately wanted to know what truth is all about. And I had reached the point by then of realizing that I needed God. I didn't know what God was, and I remember, because I had not really believed in God until then, I had believed, I had been subjected, browbeaten into thinking that he was this or that. None of it made sense to me. But I remember one time I was trying to find truth all my life, but I would not find it in science, I didn't find it in political systems, I didn't find it in the arts, I didn't find it in the beauties of nature. And whereas I could enjoy the beauties, I couldn't feel them. There was something wrong with me. I was like a motor working on only one cylinder. And I was feeling desperate. And I remember this one walk I took late at night, asking myself the question, if there is a God, what must he be like? And I thought, well, he can't be an old man with a long white beard. That doesn't make any sense. He can't be like that supposed God behind the altar at the Sistine Chapel, in which he's throwing his arms like this as if rejecting all the sinners in the world and dooming them to hell. I thought, that doesn't make sense. If I had created this universe, I wouldn't hate my creation the way that God does. I would love it. I would want to help it. No, God can't be that. And I finally thought, well, at least this much has to be true. I am asking this question consciously. No mere robot could be so programmed as to ask questions of this nature. I have to be a conscious being. And I'm asking this question consciously. Therefore, he must be consciousness. And if he is consciousness, then I have to be a part of that consciousness. And if I am a part of it, I find that there are times when I'm more a part of it and other times when I have less clarity. And I must do those things in my life that will give me more clarity, so that I can understand more deeply who I really am. And I remember returning to my apartment that night. I was rooming with four other young men. And they were in the kitchen laughing and joking. And I was so overwhelmed with the greatness of this thought that my life's purpose has to be only this, to seek God. And I remember when they began laughing at me for being serious, and I thought, why listen to these yapping puppies? And I decided from then on I would seek God. But I didn't know how. I didn't know where to begin. I didn't know anything about meditation. I didn't even know if anybody in history had ever sought God. I thought maybe I was going crazy. And for a long time, I had to struggle with that doubt. And then somehow I stumbled upon the teachings of India. And I was absolutely thrilled. First of all, because they talked of the need for experience. It wasn't enough just to believe. I thought, what's the use of belief? People used to believe the world is flat. That didn't make it flat. Belief isn't the real test of Christianity. Experience has to be. How can I experience truth? How can I experience God? And I remember my father. This is where God himself intervened, because he sent my father. He was an oil geologist for Esso, and Esso sent him to Cairo, Egypt, to seek oil there. And to me, this is a sign that it was meant to be for my sake mainly, because he didn't find oil there, and Esso decided to give up trying. But Mobil, which came in later, found oil exactly where my father had said they would find it. Esau just gave up too soon. So he went there uselessly as far as his job went, but very usefully as far as I was concerned. And I put my mother on the ship to join him. And the very day I put my mother on that ship, I went uptown New York and I entered a bookstore, and there I found Autobiography of a Yogi. And I read that book, and it absolutely changed my life. I had been willing to give up everything to go and live as a hermit in a Brazilian forest or any place where I could just be alone and seek God. And the most I hoped for was at least a little peace of mind. And in this book, I found that God is such perfect love, such perfect joy. And I found in him attitudes that were absolutely thrilling. His attitude toward everything was just perfect. And I realized, this must be my calling. I took the next bus from New York to Los Angeles. And the first words I addressed to Yogananda when I met him were, "I want to be your disciple." And I've never varied in that commitment and conviction. This is now more than 62 years that I've been his disciple. But I have to say that what he taught, what he was, what he showed by his example, by the sweetness and the love, absolutely unconditional for everybody, it was so thrilling that my goal in life, as well as being here in Los Angeles, is to help you all to know what a jewel you had in him, and he is still here. I remember I said to him once, when you were gone, will you be as near to us as you are now? He said, to those who think me near, I will be near. And I have seen this again and again. And if my life has accomplished anything, it is due to his inspiration and the guidance that I feel in myself. And many and many and many a time, I've had serious questions to ask, but I asked him and I had the answer just like that in a moment. He is here. He is here today. He is with us right now. And if you take seriously what I'm telling you, you are living as it was in the days of Christ when Jesus walked the earth. You are living in the same days and you have the same opportunity. And if you will give your life to God, and if you take him as your teacher or as your example, you will be amazed at how your life changes. How has my life changed? In one way particularly, I feel an almost constant bliss. I don't know how to describe it, except as bliss. What is bliss? Is a state of feeling absolutely happy all the time. So that if people treat you badly, it doesn't matter. Be even-minded. Be cheerful. I remember one time when I was 13, I weighed 107 pounds. There was a boy living in the room next to me at school, where I lived in a boarding school, and he was 15, and he weighed 230 pounds. You have to admit there's a slight difference between 107 and 230. And he decided he couldn't take it from me anymore. I was an insult to the American flag. I had an English accent because I'd grown up in Europe and been educated in England. And he just decided that he was going to give it to me. And I remember sitting next to him at dinner, and he was saying to me things like, "Don't you know you should drink your soup out of the far side of the bowl, peasant?" And I just calmly went on with my meal. And that made him all the more furious. And he said, boy, am I going to get you. And I knew he was planning it. I didn't know what I could do. I couldn't lock the door. We had no keys to our doors. He burst into my room and proceeded to beat me up in such a manner that I had nothing to do. There was nothing I could do about it. I just lay there and covered my head with my arms as well as I could and let him vent his fury. And I remember him panting in a whisper so that nobody else would hear. I'm going to throw you. I'm sorry. I'm going to throw you out the window. I'm going to throw you out the window. And I just had to think, well, all right, he throws me out the window. He throws me out the window. We were three stories up from the ground. Somebody later said to me, why didn't you cry for help? It hadn't even occurred to me. But I said, I wasn't afraid. Whatever, if people want to treat me this way, fine. I found that that attitude has served me in very good stead in life. That whatever happens, let it happen. Accept it as a gift from God. And I have to say this, although he beat me within an inch of my life, I beat him because I didn't react. He didn't know what to do after that. So he left me very strictly alone. You will always win if you take everything just calmly and accept it as coming from God and let him decide what he wants to do with you. You will see that life will be for you an unbroken story of bliss. Did I feel bliss at that moment? No, I have to admit I didn't. But I did feel those attitudes that have developed gradually over the years into a bliss that doesn't change. And this is the goal of your life. The goal of life is bliss. Any other questions? Mind you, you have less than 1 minute to ask.
Thank you. I was just wondering if you can tell us, what's your feeling about the place of this world that you came here? For example, the country or the nation? Does it have a significant impact in your life as you develop spiritually and what your work is to offer to others? Thank you.
I wasn't quite sure myself. Why did you come to this country, I think, is the question. Did you have a...
place that you were born, is there any special significance?
Is there a special significance of where you were born?
Well, my being born in Romania naturally has raised that question for me, because my parents were born in Oklahoma, which is a little distant from Romania. But my father, being an oil geologist, he was sent there to find oil. But I think that there is a reason for where we are born, and that reason may come out gradually in time. I think that my reason for being born in Romania is that Romania is sort of half Oriental, half Western, and my life has been to span Western and Eastern consciousness. Romania was a very medieval country when I grew up. To give you an example, wanting to become modern, they spent one whole year going on daylight losing time. Everybody else shifted their clocks one way, Romania shifted it the wrong way. It was a medieval country. And I must say, coming to America and all this modernity, it took a little getting used to. But I think that I was born there because I, speaking many languages, as I do now, I speak about 8 languages, and I've lectured in 5. And I think what it has done has helped me to appreciate different points of view, to understand why people think the way they do. It has been a great advantage to me in helping to other people by teaching them to realize that there is a rationale even to stupidity. And so don't judge people. Accept them as they are, because each one in his own way is trying his best. So where you were born has some meaning, but I think we have to dig into our subconscious to understand why. Why are some people born with black skin, some people with yellow skin, some people with white skin or brown skin? There's no difference between any of us. We're all basically the same. There are no races of men to be defined by color of the skin. That's superficial. You take the skin off and we're all red. But if you understand that the real races of men are what is known in India as the caste system. It isn't a system as such, but it's an explanation. Some people are naturally inclined to just work with their hands, to think less, act more. Other people, once they begin to discover that they have intelligence, begin to think, how can I use this intelligence for my own benefit? And so they become what is known as the merchant caste. But not all merchants are merchants. It's a kind of attitude toward life. And then gradually, as you live longer, you begin to find that you are happier, not when you keep taking from people, but when you share with people. There was this woman I met in Taormina in Sicily many years ago. And it was a hot day and I wanted to buy a hat. But because I never wear a hat, I didn't know quite what kind of hat to buy. So I asked her, what kind of hat do your customers like? She said, I don't know, I just take their money and they leave. That's the last I think about it. And I thought, I said to her, what a waste of time. Here you are in your shop, 8 hours a day maybe. You have an opportunity to make friends with people, and you just think of in terms of what money you can get out of them. I said, is that making you happy? I don't think so. There's something wrong with that attitude. You have such an opportunity here to make friends. Well, I thought, there's no point in going back to that woman again, because I didn't see any hope. But you know, I came back there the next year, and I saw her outside her shop. And she came over to me with tears. And she said, thank you. You've changed my life. And they gave me a bottle of wine for being a repeat customer at the hotel. And so I had no use for the wine. So I thought of her and I gave her this wine, and she was actually weeping. I had changed her life by pointing out this perfectly simple truth. But now she makes friends with people. By our own discovery, we can find out how to live. But people are people everywhere in the world, and they're basically the same. The color of your skin means nothing. If you were a spiritual, you could have green skin, it wouldn't matter. But where you are in your level of spiritual evolution shows how close you are to the bliss of which I have been speaking. Okay. God bless you all.